Isaiah 5:18-5:30. The sixth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on November 8, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Is to finish chapter 5. I started chapter 5 last week. My plan is to finish it this week. And then at the end I want to take on a general question that was asked last week. If you'll recall, chapter 5 begins with this parable. It's a verbal picture that Isaiah is using. The picture is a very simple one. He tells the story of a vintner who plants a vineyard. He goes to all lengths to assure that this vineyard will do well, that it will prosper, and that it will flourish and provide him with good fruit. Having done everything that a good vintner would do to get a good vineyard started, this vineyard produces only bad fruit. So Isaiah, obviously speaking for God, asks the rhetorical question, what would you do if this happened? And explains what the natural response to such a thing would be, and that is to withdraw the care and concern that he has provided for this vineyard. He's no longer going to pull up the weeds. He's no longer going to prune the vines. Furthermore, he's going to tear down the walls and the hedges, and the vineyard will revert back to its natural state. The animals will come in and trample it. It will be destroyed as a vineyard. Furthermore, this vintner is going to do something that most vintners couldn't, and that is withhold the rain. So he's kind of stepping out of his metaphor and beginning to already tip his hand as to what stands for what in this metaphor that he's created. God is the vintner, and the vineyard is Israel. And Israel has not responded the way that God had expected and wanted Israel to respond to him. It has not produced good fruit. It has produced only bad. And as a result, God is going to allow it to become a wasteland. Then he begins to list some of the specific charges that he has against Israel. They're a list of, he says, woe to those. And there are a series, there are six woe to's. And the first two he separates out, and he gives an appropriate punishment in response to these woes. The first woe is greed. What he describes is that the people of Israel are adding to their land. They're making huge estates by buying out their neighbors and creating a huge farm. And the response to that is that, first of all, they become lonely as they are isolated on this estate. They have driven out all of their neighbors. But all the homes of Israel will be evacuated. Even the wealthiest will be evacuated by the coming punishment. And there will be no harvest. Apparently the cause for the evacuation is a lack of food. So although they've created these huge estates, it will not produce for them. there will not be the expected return from these estates. So their greediness has gotten them nothing. God has turned what they were trying to do and given them the absolute opposite result. So rather than abundance, they're getting scarcity as a result of their greed. In all of these woes, God matches the punishment with the offense. The second offense is the people of Israel, people of Judah, giving themselves over to distraction, drinking wine and banqueting, feasting. And because they have given themselves over to this distraction, and they've given themselves over this distraction instead of thinking about dwelling upon what God has done and what God is doing, the works of God. Rather than focusing on what God is doing in this world, they have distracted themselves. They've given themselves over to entertainment. The form of entertainment they've chosen is drinking and eating. What will be the punishment? One that is fitting to that. They will starve and be thirsty. They will be deprived of this means of entertainment. And furthermore, Sheol will open its mouth and feast on them, the punishment that's yet to come. And the land, as a result, will be desolate. The people of Judah will be taken into exile. And the end result will be sheep grazing on this same land. So the same land, rather than being populated with these people who are partying, will be pasture land. Sheep will be grazing on it, and it will be the sheep of foreigners. For some reason, reading this reminds me of a painting that I saw when I was in Rome. It was a painting that was done during the Renaissance. And it shows the very center of Rome, and you can tell because there's some columns that are sticking up above the ground. All you can see is the top, about 10 feet of each column. But if you've seen modern-day Rome, you recognize them. They're right down in the middle of the forum. But the dirt has come up to that level, and it's all green grass, and instead of sheep, it has cows grazing there. But it's an incredible sight, because you think of Rome and the glory that was Rome, and then over the years, mud and dirt filled in, and it turned into pasture, and there's nobody there. Just cows. It's a very interesting painting of Rome and a very interesting image that Rome, which was once the richest and most powerful city in the world, over a period of time became a pasture. Well, he is saying the same thing of Israel, of Judah. Judah will become pasture land for the sheep of foreigners because of their rebelliousness. And that's interesting because it brings us back to the initial metaphor of the vineyard in which the walls would be torn down and it would become a wasteland, no longer a vineyard, with the animals coming in and trampling the remaining vines. Okay, so now that's what we talked about last week. Now we'll go on. He lists some more woes, and he lists them all together rather than separating out a punishment for each one. It's just a list of four more woes and then a more general punishment that he gives. Let me read what the rest of the woes are, starting with verse 18 in chapter 5. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. So there are four categories of violations of God's law here that he singles out. The first one, I have no idea what he's talking about. The woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes. I don't know what the image there is there. I'm not sure what he's getting at. Somehow, the sin is closely attached to the person such that it follows him everywhere. It is a part of him. It's a burden that he carries. I'm not sure exactly what the image is here. The second part is clearer. Who say, and these are apparently the same people, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. This is clearer. This is something I think we can identify with and that we see. And that is people saying, let God show himself, let him prove himself. If God adequately proves himself to me, then I will believe. Let him do his thing so I can see it. Let him do his thing so I can know it. Then I'll believe. It's really an arrogance on the part of man that if God qualifies for my belief, then I will grant it, but only if he qualifies on my terms. What God is saying here is that all Isaiah's statement is, you, the people of Judah, have been rebellious, and judgment is coming. And there are some who are saying, prove it to us. Let's see God do what you say he's going to do. Then we'll believe. That's the spirit of rebellion in and of itself. The next woe. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. This is another recognizable phenomenon, I think. And that is the inversion of what is right and what is wrong. And it happens all the time. It is curious that there are several times in history when historians have noted this happening in times of great social turmoil, that people will begin to elevate that which is evil and use words that describe it that make it appear as though it is good, and take things that are good and use terms to describe them that make it appear as though it's evil. I was trying to think of a few examples. I'll start out with the obvious and then get less obvious. But something like abortion is couched in terms of getting rid of unwanted children. So it's making a virtue of taking the lives of unborn children. It's in the name of love, of course, that these children are being put to death. So we're elevating murder to a virtue, and we are demeaning a sense of responsibility on the part of the parents for any children that they conceive to love them and raise them. We're saying that is not good. That's not worth doing. The way that divorce is justified in our society, I think, is a similar kind of thing. That divorce is for, oftentimes, for the sake of the children or the sake of the relationship. That what we're saying is breaking oaths is a good thing because it frees us. It's stifling to stay in a difficult relationship. One that I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about is what makes us, as human beings, what makes us worth anything? What gives us value? And the thing that we usually look to is how much money and how much fame do we have? Society as a whole attaches worth to a person on that basis. And it's difficult to look at things differently than that. And yet from God's perspective, the thing that makes us worthy is moral virtue, living a righteous life, doing what God has asked us to do. As a result, the society's system of worth is an inversion. It's honoring the things that man honors, giving value to what man honors rather than what God honors. This tendency of ours to invert, we have become masters of spin, to take that which is evil and use the words to describe it that make it sound virtuous, and take that which is truly virtuous and use words to describe it that make it sound as if it is a bad thing. We do it all the time. During the time of upheaval in Greek history, in the Peloponnesian Wars, Thucydides commented on this very phenomenon of people in their rhetoric taking evil things and using terms to describe them that made it sound good and virtuous. Same thing happened in the French Revolution, and that was commented upon by many. And similar things happened under Hitler. The terms that he used to describe, I can't remember what it is, but there's some cute expression he used, name he used for the wagons that were used to haul the Jews off to the death camps. It was something like, I don't know, Social Security something, wagons or something. But we're great. We are spin artists. And what we do is we invert. Take that which is wicked, make it sound virtuous, and vice versa. The third woe that he lists here. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. We really think that we are quite smart as human beings. We think, and we are. We think we are quite smart, and we can figure things out, and that is remarkably true. But there is something very dangerous about some knowledge. I had a professor in college. In the first day of class, he said that there had been a rumor going around that this course is a Mickey Mouse course. He said, I don't want to disappoint you. He said, if you turn in a blank piece of paper with just your name on it for the final, I will give you a C. If you decide to answer some of the questions and you get them wrong, you risk getting a D or an F. He said, it's better to know what you know than to think you know something and be wrong. I'm not sure that I agree with all of his pedagogy, but the principle is very right. The principle is really very important. We as human beings think that we have got things figured out, and we proceed accordingly in our arrogance, thinking that we have mastered an understanding of this complex reality that we live in, and proceed with the confidence that we can solve the problems and arrange and orchestrate things to our good. There is a book that I got last year that is one of my prized possessions. It's called Why Things Bite Back. And if any of you have been in my classes, I'm sure you've heard me mention this more than enough times. But it's a fascinating book. It's a book that describes technological advances that man has made, technological innovations that he's developed, and for a specific good purpose. And then it goes on to describe how consistently it has the opposite result. I'll just use one example. Boxing. It used to be an old-fashioned boxing that they wore no gloves, so it was bare knuckles, and the boxers would get in the ring and just clobber on each other, and as they clobbered on each other, there would be blood all over the place. So it was decided that we need to make boxing more humane. We need to clean it up. So what we're going to do is we're going to put these gloves on their fists so that we don't have this horrible thing happening. So they can box and we won't have this all this bloodshed. And it worked. They put these gloves on, and now they go at it in the ring, and you wouldn't have all this blood anymore. It was fantastic. In the long run, however, there was a problem, and that is, if you have a glove on your hand, you can hit as hard as you want. Before you had a glove on your hand, you couldn't hit real hard, because if you hit real hard, you would break the bones in your hand. And then you would not be very effective with that hand for the rest of that match. So there was a limit on how hard you could hit. Then they put the glove on the fist. Now there's no limit. No blood, but you can hit a lot harder. So what happens? We have someone like Muhammad Ali who comes out punch drunk. It does brain damage. No blood, but brain damage. So the very thing that they sought to achieve by making boxers wear gloves created the opposite result of making it actually more brutal rather than less brutal. And he goes through example after example after example of this very thing. Technological innovations used for good purposes, but quite unknown to the innovators, the opposite result was achieved in the long run. That is the nature of human wisdom. We consistently achieve the opposite result of what we intend because we are ultimately ignorant. But we are ignorant of our ignorance. We are arrogant. The beginning of wisdom is a respect for God, and that necessitates a humility. And that was what was lacking in the people that Isaiah is addressing here. And the last of the woes. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Here again it's drinking, but here it's drinking for a different purpose. Before it was drinking as a form of distraction. Here, it's drinking as self-indulgence, because these people are heroes only insofar as they are drinkers. That's the thing that sets them apart. That's the area in which they are distinguished. But they run roughshod over the oppressed. They take bribes, and they take away the rights of those who are in the right. So they're given over to self-indulgence rather than service of justice, service of what is right. So those are the offenses that God has listed out as being true of the people of Judah. So their punishment is coming, and he describes that. There are two parts to it. There's a first phase and a second phase. The first phase starts at verse 24 and 25. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. So a punishment is coming. It is going to be fast and complete. If you've ever seen fire sweep through dry grass, that's a potent image. It moves quickly. And what's left is just a little bit of ash. Well, similarly, this punishment is going to come and sweep over Judah. And their root, and I think what he means to symbolize there is their stability. Their root will become like rot, and their blossom, and I'm not sure exactly what it means by blossom. It may mean the future, or it may mean their glory. I'm not sure which image he has in mind, but those seem like the two most likely. Those two that will be done away with, that will blow away as dust. Why? Because they have rejected the law of God. They've been rebellious. So God in his anger is going to punish them in this fashion. And the mountains quaked. I don't know what this is referring to, whether there will, it's implying an actual earthquake that will accompany this punishment or be a part of this punishment, or whether it's talking about the mountains quaking, rumbling with the approaching army. I tend to think it's probably the latter, that the mountains quaked in the sense of vibrated with the approaching army. And their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. So it's going to be utter devastation as a result of this punishment. But his hand is still stretched out. That's not all. More is coming. That's described in the following verses. 26. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation, and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps, nor is the belt at its waist undone, nor its sandal strap broken. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The hooves of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like young lions. It growls as it seizes the prey, and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. So, God is going to instigate the approach of this formidable army. He's going to lift up a standard to call the army to the standard and whistle for it from the ends of the earth. One commentary I consulted thought that this was an allusion to a practice of ancient beekeepers who had a way of whistling or humming that would cause the bees to gather. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting image if it's true. In any case, God is going to hold up this standard, and the armies are going to come to it. And this army is going to be a nasty army. You can kind of sense in the words that he uses, this is a very determined and formidable force that's going to come. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps. Nor is the belt at its waist undone. Nor its sandal strap broken. They're ready. They're coming. Its arrows are sharp, all of its bows are bent. The hooves of its horses seem like flint. That's important. Horses in ancient times didn't wear horseshoes. That's a development of the Middle Ages. So horses that didn't have strong hooves were worthless. These hooves are strong. Its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. So this is a formidable foe that's on its way. And you can almost sense its mercilessness. It's roaring like a lioness. 10 years ago, We were at the San Francisco Zoo just before they fed the lions. And the lions were roaring in anticipation. It was quite a spectacle. I'd never heard that before. It's intimidating. And so this, it's like the lions roaring. That's clearly something that should get their attention. And it shall roar over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. And then the last part, if one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. I assume that he's talking about an image of a cloud growing over the land, whether that's from the army or from the destruction of the army, I'm not sure. But there's something that causes a darkness to come over the land, presumably a cloud. And so there's darkness and distress. Even the light is darkness, darkened by its clouds. Now, I think that the two things that are happening here, they probably best correlate with the first one, being an attack that was launched against Judah by the Syrians, by the Arameans. And that did precede, by not very much, the coming of the Assyrians. There are Syrians, and then there are Assyrians. Those are two different groups. The Syrians come from the area around Damascus. They were afraid of the approach of the Assyrians. So they formed an alliance with the Kingdom of Israel. And together, those two nations attacked Judah because Judah would not join in the alliance with them. So Judah was attacked and many people were killed, but that invasion did not last long because the Assyrians came anyway. They swept through, defeated the Arameans, defeated the Israelites, the northern kingdom, and almost overcame the Judeans. They conquered most of the land of Judah. The only area that they did not conquer was the capital city, Jerusalem. So apparently those are the two punishments that he is describing here. So that's what's going to happen in response to the wickedness of Israel. That is an event that was foretold in Deuteronomy. Moses, when he gave the law, he said, "If you do not obey me, I will send a nation." I should have written down that reference, because it's probably worth looking at this point. Does anyone recall exactly where that is? Okay, here it is. It's in Deuteronomy 28, verse 49. This is a good thing to remind ourselves of. This was foretold before the people of Israel even went into the land of Palestine. This is what Moses said to the people of Israel would happen if they disobeyed the law of God. Verse 49, "The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, who shall have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young. Moreover, it shall eat the offspring of your herd and the produce of your ground until you are destroyed, who also leaves you no grain, new wine, or oil, nor the increase of your herd, or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. And it shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you have trusted come down throughout your land. And it shall besiege you in all your towns throughout your land which the Lord your God has given you. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you during the siege and distress by which your enemy shall oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother and toward the wife he cherishes and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give even one of them any of the flesh of his children which he shall eat, since he has nothing else left during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in all your towns. the refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement, shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes, and toward her son and daughter, and toward her afterbirth which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she shall eat them secretly for lack of anything else during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in your towns. So that was foretold very early. It's a very gruesome picture, but I think it's describing the same event that Isaiah has foretold at a much later date. Okay, so what is, just summarizing, what is this chapter about? Isaiah is saying that there is an imminent and horrible destruction that is awaiting Judah because they have been rebellious against God. They have been greedy. They have been given over to distraction. They have been only willing to accept God on their own terms. They have rationalized evil. They think that they are wise, and they have perverted justice. Even though God throughout has been faithful to protect them, to take care of them, they have been rebellious, and as a result, there will be total devastation. Two invading forces will come in and wipe them out. Now, there are two verses here that are a repeat of verses that were first mentioned in chapter 2. And those verses are verses 15 and 16. So the verses 15 and 16 become a bit of a refrain through this early part of Isaiah. And they say, "So the common man will be humbled, and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness." Again, there's been a monumental inversion that's taking place in the people of Judah. And that is, they have set themselves as judge over God's principles. They have decided which of God's principles they will live by and which ones they will not live by. So they're standing in judge over God's law, over God's principles. As a result, there's that inversion. They have become, they have put themselves in the place of God. And over time, God is saying, "I am going to right that inversion. All of mankind, whether he be wealthy and important or whether he be humble and a common man, it does not matter. They will be put in their place. They will be humbled. But I, God, alone in that day will be exalted." That God alone will be in the rightful place where he belongs, exalted and over all. That's one of the underlying themes throughout this early part of Isaiah, and a very important one, and I think essentially the theme of human history. And the invasion of the Syrians and the invasion of the Assyrians are but a down payment towards that righting of the hierarchy in human existence, of God taking his rightful place. Now, I want to address a question that came up last week. Ken asked, why does God keep punishing the Jews, the Israelites, when punishment obviously does not work? If I remember his question correctly, that's what he asked. Why does God, is it not the case that God punishes the Jews for their rebelliousness, and what happens? They're rebellious again. They sin again. And it happens time after time after time. One can list many, many instances of that throughout. That's what the Old Testament chronicles. So why is it that God keeps punishing them when it doesn't work? Well, I have three. I've been thinking over the last week, how would I respond to that more fully? I think there are three things that we need to recognize. First of all, we don't know in full what God's up to. We know in part, but we don't know in full. So it's difficult for us to say when something works, unless we know what he's doing. Secondly, even if we know what he's doing, how do we know that it's not working? Time's not up. It could be that everything he's doing is progressing towards that, his end. And I believe his end is to bring about a nation that is truly responsive to God, that embraces him heart and soul. So that's secondly, is how do we know that it is not working? And the third is, I think we can give a partial answer to what God is up to. I think we can assume that what God wants is for Israel as a nation to embrace him heart and soul. Does the punishment of Israel contribute to that, is the question. And I think we can acknowledge it's not immediately obvious that it does so. But think about your own life. What role has pain and suffering played in your own life? Has it brought about, has it moved you in the direction of embracing God heart and soul? If you look at mankind in general, I think the answer is for some yes and for some no. For some yes and probably for the majority no. But how does that work when it does bring people to embrace God heart and soul? How does that come about? Well, I think by inflicting pain upon us, God is doing the same thing that he did with the plagues in the Exodus in Egypt. If you'll remember back to Exodus, before Pharaoh was willing to let the Israelites go, God inflicted 10 plagues on the people of Egypt. And in each case, the plague was turning the forces of nature against the Egyptians. Now, the reason that was important is because in the Egyptian religion, the main job of the Egyptians, of their gods, was to keep the forces of nature under control. The Egyptians lived in a very favorable environment. As long as the floods came at the right times, as long as they were gentle, they receded at the right times, the sun kept shining the way it had always shone, as long as the winds kept blowing upstream, because that's the way they went upstream and then they floated downstream. As long as everything kept working the way it usually did, then they were in good shape. They could grow more grain than any other part of the ancient world. So what they needed was gods that would control the natural forces. So when God came in to claim his people, he said, I can guarantee the failure of your gods. And I will guarantee the failure of your gods. So he disrupted the natural forces, and the Egyptian priests were powerless to change that. Pain and suffering serves the same kind of role in our lives. We set ourselves up as gods. We do just what the serpent said in the Garden of Eden. We become like gods, knowing good and evil, standing in judge over what is right and wrong for us. We become gods, and as gods, our number one purpose is to preserve our own comfort and security. And as long as the stock market stays where it is, we think we're doing a pretty good job. We're pretty good gods. But it's when pain and suffering comes in that it proves that we are not very good gods. we aren't capable of doing our main task, the main task we've given ourselves. So pain and suffering serves an enormously important role in our lives. It puts things into perspective. It tells us who we really are. It tells us what we really can do and what we really can't do. It brings down our idols. I think similarly, the same thing happens in the life of a nation. God is doing the same thing in the life of Judah that he does in the lives of individuals. That through his constant exhortation and the punishments for wrongdoing, he's teaching them who Yahweh really is. And in the end, I'm confident, his purposes will win out. Judah will come to know who God really is. But were they not to, they would have had no excuse, just as anyone, any human being, has no excuse for rejecting God for who he is. We have all suffered. We all have good reason to understand that we are not the gods that we would like to think that we are, and that our only salvation is to turn to the one true God. So I think, in answer to Ken's question, it will work. That God will bring about his purposes. It may seem messy. It may seem like it has taken a long time for it to work. I don't know why it's taken so long and why it's still happening. But I'm confident that it will work. What God is trying to achieve, he will achieve, and he has more purposes than we know. Any questions or comments? Do we have someone running a mic around?
What about the... one of the reasons I guess I'd heard, and it made sense to me, that God punishes when there doesn't seem to be any response, is... I think I'm getting this from a teaching in Deuteronomy when the Israelites were given the law, and Moses says, I set before you a blessing and a curse, and basically neither one of those things is going to make any difference. You won't be good for a blessing, and you won't change your ways for a curse. And the purpose of that is to make you realize that the fundamental problem is not one of ignorance, that you need a carrot or a stick, because neither the carrot nor the stick will make any difference. And you need to learn that the problem is you. It's not ignorance. You can't say, we didn't know, because we've got this carrot and stick, and in the long run you will observe that it will not make the slightest bit of difference in the world. You will recognize the problem is inherently in you. Could you comment on that? Is that perhaps the fourth reason for the punishments that don't seem to do anything, that one of the objectives is not specifically to change, to cause change, but to make us realize that the problem is not something that blessings and curses, which fundamentally have to do with the problem of ignorance, blessings and curses have anything, are relevant to, when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm. If I use the analogy of God inflicting pain on us as individuals, I'm not sure that we can always know why that's happened. That it is not always in response to disobedience. I've reached the conclusion that God's ways are really, to a large extent, beyond our knowing. And that he does some of the strangest things that you just cannot figure out. But I trust that he has his purposes and he is working those out, and he's doing right by me. And oftentimes I can learn a great deal from those experiences, but to know why he did it, I can only know in part. Could it be in part what you've suggested? Yeah, I think that's true. I think it could be.
This might not be real clear because I'm just thinking it for the first time, but I've always made a distinction between discipline and punishment. Uh-huh. Discipline having the opportunity for learning, growing, shaping, molding, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and punishment being just take this and feel bad, end of sentence.
Yeah.
Do you think that God ever just punishes without the intent to actually discipline?
Well, I'm convinced he's not masochistic. That he doesn't just enjoy pain. That the pain has purpose. I haven't been making that kind of distinction when I've been using the word punish. I punish my children. I punish them for wrongdoing. But that punishment is all part of a larger scheme of discipline. So I'm not making the same kind of distinction that you have made. But God subjects us to, I would say, punishment in the way that I'm using it. And it is for a purpose. It's not just because he likes pain, but because he is trying to elicit a positive response from us. From some people, he will never achieve that. Some will never embrace him as Lord and Savior. And his strategy seems to be to ratchet it up. That the more one rebels, the more one is going to run into consequences of that rebellion. And so it becomes, in a sense, more painful. But there are some who will never respond, that they will continue in rebellion, despite that. But they can't say, I have no way of knowing that what I was doing was wrong. I think that's part of his strategy.
And you believe his strategy has in it, the way that I'm using discipline, that intention?
Mm-hmm.
That there's not, and part of the reason why I ask has a little bit to do with thinking about parenting and, you know, that kind of thing, but actually more, you know, a lot of the New Testament that I don't understand appears to present a God who sometimes just is really getting mad, and it seems more like a, I just want you to feel bad, without the intention of, it's not clear that they're in the story, what's, I want you to actually learn here. And that might, probably is just my ignorance when it comes to stories in the Old Testament. Would you agree?
Yes,
I'm ignorant.
Partially. But that, the analogy with parents is an excellent one. Because I inflict pain on my children in times when I'm sure they can't understand what I'm doing. Especially with Seth. They just are not old enough to understand what purposes I'm trying to accomplish in their lives, what I'm trying to achieve. So for them, it's just pain. Why shouldn't he be able to put all of the dish towels in the oven and turn it on? No good reason. And he got spanked for it. So he can't understand my purposes, but my purposes are ultimately redemptive. And I think we're in a similar kind of situation where we can't always see the redemptive element to what he's doing. It looks like just pain. But I'm confident that if we could see the whole picture, we could see there's a redemptive element to everything that he's doing.
For those who he's not working in their hearts to have them hearts towards them, it wouldn't be a redemptive element for them personally, but a redemptive element in the whole story. Would that be right?
Well, it's like if we take the analogy of parents again. If you have a child that is bent on rebellion, how do you handle them?
But you're not sovereign. Right?
Right. But talking in terms of God dealing with us and this experience of life, that the way he deals with this, I think, is analogous to the way that a parent deals with children, such that he is giving every reason for belief. He's giving every reason, doing everything he can, in a sense, to bring the rebellious to him, to show them, to face them into their rebelliousness, I guess would be the best way to put it.
That makes sense to me. I think that in thinking about sovereignty, in that part that's not analogous to parenting. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
That ultimately, for the individual that he's not drawn unto himself, mm-hmm. he has painted a very clear picture of the evil in the human heart and where we go without grace.
Right.
But it has not been for the ultimate purpose of redeeming that individual.
Right. That's right. Right, in that sense. Jack, Chris.
Following up on that, I'm also struggling with the idea of punishment versus discipline. It seems like in the Deuteronomy passage especially, he's being very clear about saying, if you do this, you get this, and if you do this other thing, you're going to get this. And then they get it.
Right.
They do that, and they get it. And it sounds like a sentence, in a way. And yet, if I'm understanding what you're saying, even that is consequences, in the sense of, you could even say natural consequences, and he's filling in that this is what those consequences would be. And you have a choice. And so it's not punitive in the sense of our legal system, for example, where we need to get someone out off the streets in order to protect others, whether or not they ever figure out that what they did was wrong. That God's purpose is to point to what is right and what is